Our guest first, the UK neurologist who will advise New Zealand doctors on prescribing medicinal cannabis. Professor Mike Barnes is calling on the profession here to get itself ready to prescribe the drug. Endorsed by the Royal New Zealand College of GPs, it'll be Royal Australia New Zealand College of GPs, he will give talks around the country later this month. He is recognised as the leading European expert on medicinal cannabis. In 2016, he was tasked with writing a report for the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Drug Policy Reform on the evidence for medicinal cannabis. The Ministry of Health last week issued proposed regulations for the use of medicinal cannabis, and these are out for public consultation. There remains uncertainty among GPs over whether they will themselves be able to prescribe or will need to refer patients to a specialist for sign-off. The draft regulation suggests doctors or GPs would only be able to prescribe some cannabinoid products approved by the Ministry of Health, of which there is only one, Sativex. Other medicines containing THC would be subject to stricter oversight and would need a specialist sign-off before being prescribed. Some GPs argue that they are indeed specialists, and that situation needs to be clarified during the consultation process. How does all this compare with how things are working in the UK? For his insights, Dr. Mike Barnes is with us from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
Doctor or professor, by the way, please, Mike.
Professor, but it doesn't hugely matter, but that's what it is.
I'm in a particularly pedantic mood this morning, so forgive me. You've been working in the area of rehabilitative medicine for 30 years. At what point and how did your interest in medicinal cannabis develop?
Well, it developed quite a long time ago, about 15, 20 years ago, when I was working with multiple sclerosis patients in our National Health Service clinics. And a few patients came to the clinic and told me that they've got some benefit from using cannabis. And at the time, of course, it was illegal. And they said that it's very helpful for their pain and for their muscle spasticity, as it's called in multiple sclerosis. So very informally, I asked everyone who came to the clinic, it was about 50 patients. And to my surprise, really, about half of them were using cannabis illegally at that time. So I thought, well, there must be something to this. Otherwise, they wouldn't be criminalizing themselves. And so that sparked my interest, and it's remained there since. And, you know, cannabis is a remarkably useful, not a wonder drug, but it's a remarkably useful drug for many chronic conditions.
What has become the evidence that does show benefit, and for whom?
Well, in the study I did for the parliamentary group that you mentioned earlier, we found good evidence that was solid, really unarguable evidence for efficacy in pain. That's number one. And an experience, for example, in Canada, where it's legal now, about 70% of prescriptions are for various forms of chronic pain. That's muscular pain, arthritic pain, nerve pain, cancer pain, all sorts of pain. That's probably number one in terms of the volume and number of people that will be helped. The second is muscle spasticity, and that's quite common in, say, multiple sclerosis or stroke or after brain injury. Anxiety, the CBD component of cannabis, that's the part that doesn't get you high. It's a non-psychoactive part. That is very helpful for anxiety disorders and things like post-traumatic stress disorder. And the one that we hear a lot about, of course, is epilepsy, childhood drug-resistant epilepsy particularly, but also adult epilepsy. And that's they're the children in the UK that managed to change the law last year. And a dramatic improvement in the seizures. And the child that changed the law, called Alfie Dingley, had about 500 seizures a month, and that went eventually down to none at all. After cannabis medicine and all other anticonvulsant drugs had failed. So for those conditions, it is sometimes remarkable, but often really helpful.
The GPs here and others to whom you'll be speaking, this has been endorsed, which is why I mentioned the GPs, but obviously there are specialists of all kinds who will be interested in what you've got to say. Some of the, not scepticism, but some of what they want to hear about is whether the clinical evidence, the normal regime for testing both efficacy and safety has been completed for this drug?
Well, I think the answer is it hasn't been completed. It almost will never be completed. There's so much more we need to know about it. We need to know not just the basic conditions it helps, but which particular strain of cannabis helps most. There's about 2,500 strains of cannabis, all with subtly different, all with slightly different cannabinoids, as they're called in them, all with slightly different balances of this and that. So there's an awful lot more we need to know about which strain is best for which condition, what dose is helpful, what way of taking it is most helpful. So there's an awful lot we need to know. But my point, and I think a point now accepted in, is now 50 countries around the world where it's legal in various shapes and forms for medical purposes. They've said, well, let's start prescribing. There's enough evidence to start prescribing, but let's learn as we go along. Let's try and involve people in studies as we go along, in trials as we go along, and learn as we go. Let's not wait for those studies to be finished, which could be 4, 5, 10 years hence. Let's not wait and make those people wait for their chronic conditions. Let's start now and learn as we go along.
Another question that will come to you, I'm sure, again from doctors here is, well, let's just cut this in two. Some of the pain specialists management specialists are concerned about getting hopes up too high for chronic pain sufferers. Could you put into a realistic context the sorts of gains that some people get, but is it everybody?
It's not everybody. No, as I say, in the UK at least, we're a bit polarised. There's sort of two camps. There's those very pro-cannabis camps, the activist groups, that are saying that it's really helpful for a lot of conditions, for cancer and such like, where the evidence in some of those conditions is pretty thin. On the other side of the coin, we've got the very conservative groups in the UK of Royal College of Physicians, for example, the paediatric neurology community, who are really the opposite. They're saying we don't think the evidence is there at all. It shouldn't be prescribed. We shouldn't be using it. And I think, as with most polarized debates, the truth lies somewhere in the middle. It's a very useful drug for many conditions, but it's not the be-all and end-all. If you take pain, well, after trying 1, 2, 3 different strains of cannabis, about 70% of people trying it will be helped either a little bit or a lot with their chronic pain. And about most of them will be on opioids, for example, and about 25% can significantly reduce their dose of opioids or stop them altogether. So that's pretty good going, considering these are people who've been in chronic pain and tried most licensed drugs already. And similar for epilepsy, for example, about 70% of children with epilepsy will have their fits significantly improved. So, yeah, it's a good drug for many conditions, but it's not a wonder drug.
Did I hear you correctly that they may need to try 1, 2, or 3 different strains before even getting that benefit?
Exactly.
So that's something to be aware of, isn't it? You don't just prescribe once and forget.
No, you don't. It's a very personalised medicine. It's a bit different from normal medicine, where you take one pill for one condition, if you like. In cannabis medicine, because it's not really one medicine, it's a family of medicines. And you have to try, usually what we do is try a strain high in CBD, as I mentioned earlier, that's the non-psychoactive part, that's remarkably safe, and that will help a proportion of people. If that doesn't help, though, you then move with adding a little bit of THC, that's the psychoactive part, but because it's got CBD in it, it doesn't actually make you high, that's an important point to emphasize. And if that doesn't help, you move on perhaps to a component that has a higher THC, still counteracted by the CBD, so it still doesn't make you high. So you've got to be prepared as a doctor to do very much trial and error, very much personalised medicine, to find the particular strain in that family that suits that person and that condition. So it is a little bit more time-consuming. You've got to understand it. It's a bit more subtle than normal medicine, but with a bit of patience and with a knowledge that you'll get after initiating prescribing, you'll get there with most people.
You mentioned opioids, which are obviously very prominent in pain management, particularly chronic pain management. They've also had their controversies where they have been over-promoted or overused. Again, did I hear you say that introducing medicinal cannabis might not see the end of the need to use opioids? They may be used in conjunction.
Yes, often they're used in conjunction, but I think the important thing is to say that the dose is often reduced, and that with the reduced dose, you get reduced side effects. A proportion of people can stop opioids altogether, and that saves lives, because an important point to remember is in the UK, for example, introducing medical cannabis is likely to save about 1,000 deaths each year, and of course, it's a much bigger problem in the United States, where there's a bit of opioid epidemic. So it does save lives, and the other point to remember is you can't die of a cannabis overdosage. So you're substituting one possibly useful painkiller, but the one that has a lot of side effects and a lot of risks, with one that is also a useful painkiller but doesn't have so much of those side effects and those risks. So that in itself is a really good outcome for many people with chronic pain.
Is addiction relevant here or even significant here? Clearly it is with opioids, and their misuse became part of the picture as well. Is there any reason to talk about addiction with respect to these products, or will those using them be using them to relieve pain, not for any addictive drive?
Yes, I mean, street cannabis, cannabis that's high in that THC component, the component that gets you high and euphoric, the risk of dependency in those sort of products is something like 9%, which is actually much less than alcohol and tobacco, but nevertheless it's 9%. You know, 1 in 10 people, broadly speaking, will get a cannabis dependency syndrome. But I say that's in street high THC cannabis, and for medical use, we're generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, talking about high CBD products, and the risk of dependency in those products is not zero, but close to zero. So the risk of dependency or addiction, as you say, is very, very small indeed in medical cannabis as opposed to street cannabis.
Can we look, please, at now the system that will deliver this? The UK legalised the use of medicinal cannabis last November.
Yes.
What's been learned from that? Perhaps first, how does it work? Does it sound similar to what is proposed here?
Yeah, in many ways, the UK regulations changed and were very positive, were very quite liberal. We can prescribe for any condition in the UK that the doctor thinks might suit that particular patient, as long as they've taken into account the evidence and the guidelines. So that, and we can prescribe in any format except for smoking. We can't prescribe a joint, not surprisingly, but we can prescribe vaping or oils or creams. So that's very good. I think the mistake the UK made, and I hope New Zealand avoid, is we made it only prescribable through hospital consultant specialists, and excluded the GPs. And what you said in your introduction, I agree with entirely. GPs are specialists, particularly at the more holistic view of our patient. If you take someone with cannabis, with cancer, for example, they may have pain, they may have anxiety, they may have epilepsy, they may have poor appetite. And cannabis can help all those problems. And I think a GP is very ideally placed to look at the whole patient, the whole person, and prescribe. So I would think it would be a mistake to exclude GPs from prescribing. Because after all, the hospital specialists don't know much about cannabis medicine. That's the real issue, is lack of education. Neither do the GPs. So why exclude one group of people? Why not get anybody who is interested in cannabis medicine to learn from it? And that, in my view, should definitely include the GPs in New Zealand.
It's not clear from that. I mean, there's actually genuine confusion among the GPs. One college we spoke to says it looks like we'll have to defer, and if that's the case, it should change. And then we talked to the medical council, and they said, actually, we would count ourselves as specialists. But the suggestion is at the moment is that may need specialist sign-off. Perhaps the one reason you could argue for that were to be, is there any risk of the use of this product contravening another medication or having any kind of negative impact on a condition that a specialist is an expert on?
Very, 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 very low risk of that. Cannabis is remarkably safe. It's not without some risks, I perfectly admit that. But in terms of drug interactions, there's virtually nothing that has a significant clinical interaction. Two drugs, one anticonvulsant drug and one drug that thins the blood called warfarin. You have to be a bit careful about prescribing, but that's something the GPs will probably monitor anyway. So I think it's a mistake to say that the specialists know about cannabis medicine and are better used to sign it off. I don't agree with that. I think there's probably, in New Zealand, a similar same across the whole world. There are very, very few doctors at the moment who understand cannabis medicine. So let's train those that are interested, whatever their specialism, whatever their background, and whether they're GPs or hospital consultants. I think everyone should have the opportunity to learn. And it's not a difficult thing to learn. It takes a little bit of a different view of medicine, a little bit of a different skill. But let's not exclude half the population of medics in New Zealand by excluding the GPs.
It does appear that nurses will be able to describe the cannabinoid products, the CBD products, which do not have the psychoactive element. Would you welcome that?
Yeah, CBD is remarkably safe, and in the UK and many countries, CBD that contains no or very, very little THC is actually legal to sell openly online by the public in health food shops and such like. I'm not sure whether that is going to be the case in New Zealand, I would certainly like it to be much more available because the high CBD products can be very useful medically in their own right. And again, the problem we have in the UK is the CBD producers cannot make any medical claims for their product because they're not deemed a medical product, they're deemed a food supplement. So we've got the irony now of patients wanting a CBD product. They can get it legally, but they don't know what to do with it because it's not prescribable and they don't know what dose to take. And I'd like to see in New Zealand that problem addressed so CBD can be more widely available, perhaps through a nurse practitioner. That would be perfectly fine in my view, and reserve the doctors to advise on the, if you like, the stronger, the slightly more potent THC products. That would be, I think, reasonable.
How are the products used with anxiety? They need to be carefully used, particularly which type of product, do they not?
Yeah, high THC in its own right, it can induce anxiety. But CBD counteracts that and has the totally opposite effect. So CBD is anti-anxiety. And so for anxiety disorders, and particularly things like post-traumatic stress disorder, you really want a cannabis product that is high in CBD and very low or non-existent in THC. So again, it's just a matter of education. You've got to know that. You wouldn't prescribe a high THC product for anxiety because that has the wrong effect. So anxiety is CBD only, really.
Can we ask about supply and the availability of products? Because what I have taken from our conversation is that they are not all the same, that you may need to try different types in order to get the result that you're seeking. Does this mean that you need a healthy and quite specialised medical supply chain? And how does that work?
You do, very much so. And I think I gather that the suggestion is that products in New Zealand, like people who are like Helios Therapeutics who are putting on this course, the products will be GMP rated. That means good manufacturing practice, which means they're properly tested. They're consistent batch to batch. They don't have contaminants in it like you probably do get with street cannabis. So you can guarantee the quality of the product. You do need a range of products. In the UK, we have a bit of a ridiculous situation at the moment that if I write a prescription in my clinic, that product has to be imported because there's no homegrown UK industry as yet, and for one patient for 1 month's supply, and it can take about 2 months to get it. So we're in a ridiculous situation. If I write one prescription, I've got to write the second prescription before the product has even arrived to fulfil the first prescription. So the supply chain in the UK is daft at the moment, and I hope that the New Zealand government will address that supply chain issue. And I would love to see, as I would in the UK, a New Zealand-based industry with your own products, a good quality GMP standard with a range of products that the New Zealand doctors can prescribe, and they can get the product quickly because it's already in the country.
Who designs the recipe, though? Because are these pharmaceuticals, or are they supplements, or are they actually a mix of both? And do we need some pharmaceutical expertise in their production?
Yes, I think we do. I think most countries, not all, but most countries have set this up. Cannabis doesn't really fit into the standard medical regulatory framework. And also, it's more complicated than simply labeling it as a food supplement. So it does need something in between the two. And, for example, Holland has set up an Office of Medicinal Cannabis. That's quite common around the world, where you look slightly differently from the standard pharmaceutical product. You assess the efficacy of the product, perhaps a little bit less rigid about randomized double-blind trials because it doesn't fit that model very well, a little different look at how you regulate the product, how you supply the product. And I think a sort of halfway house between a full pharmaceutical product and a herbal food supplement type product is very reasonable for cannabis. It doesn't fit too readily. You're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole if you try and force cannabis down a fully pharmaceutical route.
What's happened to demand since legalisation in the UK, and should we anticipate quite a rush of demand?
Yeah, well, in the UK, to illustrate the problems we've got with the law change, and it's very liberal change, there's been not one single prescription on the National Health Service since the law changed on the 1st of November, not one. And that's due to the conservatism of the British doctors and, I think, ridiculously restrictive guidelines that they've managed to produce in the Royal College of Physicians and such like. So at the moment in the UK, sadly, the only way to get a prescription is in the private sector. And that's been slow to take off. We've had 22 prescriptions in the UK in total after 8 months of the change to regulations. And that's largely, but not exclusively, down to the lack of education. So I think the government rushed that change of law through. It didn't follow it up with a good quality educational program for doctors. So it's good to see New Zealand, before the law changes to a significant degree, that we're starting to educate the doctors, and they'll be more up to speed, more attuned, more ready to prescribe when the law properly changes. And therefore, I think, hopefully, your prescriptions will catch us up very quickly.
That's quite extraordinary. So after all the campaigning, all these years, there's been minimal prescribing. There's demand from patient, and then there's demand from doctor actually prescribing. So is there a tension? I mean, are there a lot of patients asking their doctors for this?
There are. I mean, in the UK, every day, the best estimate is about 1 million people will use cannabis for medical purposes, not recreational, for medical purposes. Another 2 million for recreational. And then, of course, there are the people who are happy or content to criminalise themselves. Probably you can double that number for those who don't want to criminalise themselves but would nevertheless benefit from cannabis when it's legal. So 22 prescriptions out of, let's say, conservatively, 1.5 million people is extraordinary. There's big demand. Our clinic, one clinic in London, is not quite yet open. It will open probably into this month. We have 150 people already on the waiting list. So the demand is clearly there. I hope we can manage that demand. We need to manage the expectations. Some people will think this is a wonder drug, and we've got to manage the expectations as well. So the problem has not been the law. It's been the doctors need to catch up educationally before they're happy and content and understand it enough to prescribe. So the education, I put education first, and second and third, alongside the law. We need to educate our doctors.
Is there a precedent for, whatever you want to call it, a pharmaceutical, for a medicine, is there a precedent for the approach that you outlined at the start here, which is we won't wait the 10 years or the 15 years for the medical, for the clinical trials to be completed? We anecdotally can see benefits, so we'll learn as we go. Yep. It's a big ask, isn't it, of any scientist, frankly, and of the medical profession. So is there a precedent of something being done this way before?
Probably not, actually. I think for some of the indications I mentioned a while ago, I think there is good evidence. For example, if you take nausea and sickness as one indication I didn't mention, in the context of chemotherapy, a real problem for some people with cancer, there's 26 randomized controlled studies. There's 8 randomized controlled studies to a sort of high scientific standard in pain. But on top of that, there's an awful lot of controlled, rather anecdotal studies, observational trials in epilepsy, for example. And I think we do have to adopt a slightly different view of the analysis of the evidence at the moment and accept a whole range of anecdotal evidence, a whole range of case studies, a whole range of observational trials, and not be too obsessed with a standard medical randomized placebo-controlled study, which would be very difficult to work and analyze in cannabis medicine because of that trial and error basis I've already mentioned. So I do think we need a slightly different view of assessing the evidence, but at the same time accumulating more evidence. And I personally think that the evidence is there to let's start and let's learn as we go along.
And finally, before I let you go, on that point of the clinical trials, obviously efficacy is one thing, safety is another. Are there any known side effects that need further exploration? We discussed the potential for addiction earlier, but are there any other side effects that need to be given consideration?
You do. It's not right for everybody. In the short term, the side effects are fairly minimal, while high THC products are well known to have side effects such as dizziness, disorientation, drowsiness. That's the high street cannabis that people take for those reasons, for their euphoric effects. But ignoring the short-term effects, which don't occur with CBD or CBD-based products, I think people are worried about two things. One is heart conditions, and you should be a little bit cautious about prescribing for various heart conditions because it speeds up the pulse, high THC does. And the other one that the media is always worried about, quite rightly, is the risk of psychosis in existing psychotic conditions and schizophrenia. And I would personally be very reluctant to prescribe it to someone with a history of schizophrenia or a family history of schizophrenia. There's a couple of other minor things, like some of the drug interactions I mentioned earlier, that not too concerning. But like any medicine, you've got to think, what are the negatives for this patient? And what are the positives for this patient, and weigh up the balance? And in cannabis, I think the risks to the benefits are very much in favour, mostly, of trying it out for people who have tried all other licensed medicines, remember, and have failed and are still suffering with a lot of problems with their chronic conditions.
Well, thank you for your time. Professor Mike Barnes, who will be coming to New Zealand later this month. His visit's been endorsed by the Royal Australian New Zealand College of GPs, and he will be giving classes to doctors of any college, specialists or general practitioners or others, who are interested in learning from his knowledge. As we said, in 2016, he wrote the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Drug Policy Reform report for UK politicians. He's a leading advisor throughout Europe and Canada. And he was also involved in the Dingley case, it was called, which got cannabis oil treatment approved in the UK, involving a young boy with epilepsy, Alfie Dingley.